Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Greetings. Our guests tonight are Joel Brendan Kelly of the Anchorage Press, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and from Fairbanks, Dermot Cole, columnist of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. The U.S. Senate race continues to get national attention, and this week the Anchorage Press had the first thorough profile of one of the candidates, Scott McAdams. Why don't you tell us about it, Brendan?
David Holthouse did this profile on Scott McAdams, and I think the first thing should be the line that got left out of this story, that of almost all the statewide candidates, perhaps Don Young being the exception, Scott McAdams is the only one that actually looks natural and genuine with a fishing net or with a shotgun or things like that. You know, the other candidates in other races
look like they just bought their clothes.
Yes, exactly, exactly. You know, he's what David calls a last frontier Democrat. He's for opening ANWR. It got a little bit into his history. You know, he was raised in Petersburg. He was a commercial fisherman. So he's you know, a genuine Alaskan. I believe what his campaign slogan is, I forget what it is.
I think it's some version of It's About Alaska.
It's About Alaska. You got it. Yeah, sorry about that. But it's interesting because Scott didn't expect to be running a genuine campaign in the first place, because Lisa Murkowski was supposed to be a shoe-in. They tried to get, you know, some big-name Democrats in the state, Tony Knowles, Fran Ulmer, Willie Hensley, to run for the seat, and they all, you know, thought, no, I'm not going to waste my time on this. Murkowski's a shoe-in. So Scott, being young, he's in his late 30s, I believe, mayor of Sitka, decided, you know, I'll do it. I'll take a bullet for the party and basically get some statewide recognition. And then Joe Miller won the primary, and it became a possibility. I was actually at a McAdams fundraiser before the primary, and when Scott gave his stump speech afterwards, I asked him, are you asking people to give money to you or to Joe Miller? Because the possibility that Joe Miller would win the primary in the Republican side was their one hope for Scott to be an actual contender. So it's really a story about going from this is sort of practice to, wow, we really have a shot here.
Yeah, and you can see that in his latest television ads. The tie ad, in which he's trying on a variety of ties and saying, well, you know, my wife says I got to wear a tie. If that's what it takes to be a United States Senator, well, okay, I'll wear a tie. And he's trying on all these different ties. And finally, there's a little joke at the end about the Hulk tie, which it's quite clear that he's aspiring to be the Hulk. And reminds sort of, you know, an aside from those who are making comments about his size.
He's a hulking man. Right. There's a...
There's Hulks and then there's Hulks.
His adopted Tlingit name is boat-sized killer whale, is the translation, as I found out in the story that David wrote.
Okay, thank you very much. Jill, polls, polls, and more polls. We have all kinds of polls in the U.S. Senate race. What are they telling us, and how do we make up our minds if they're reliable?
That's a good question. I know that CNN Time came out with a poll this week that had Lisa Murkowski and Joe Miller polling in the mid to high 30s, had Miller ahead by 2 points. We know local pollster Dave Dittman had also done some similar polling, which actually put Murkowski ahead by 2 points in the similar range. He won't release that poll publicly at this point in time. He may not. He says he's going to do some additional polling. And then more recently, we had Gene Kration and I believe also Ivan Moore coming out with polling results that put Murkowski double digits ahead of Joe Miller. Of course, Scott McAdams trailing all of these guys in every case. But one of the things we're hearing that's really challenging for these pollsters is, how do you deal with a write-in candidate? How do you craft your questions correctly so that people are answering earnestly about who they're going to vote for? And how do you account for the likelihood that they're going to actually be successful, you know, filling in that bubble and writing in that name instead of just choosing against people who already have their names on the ballot?
I'm sort of thinking of the wise guy question here, which would be some version. And if the election were held today, could you spell Murkowski?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, we know what they're telling us. We don't know necessarily how accurate though they are going to be historically.
And we do know
been real accurate in this race.
We do know that The Division of Elections has said voter intent is paramount, and presumably the voters have to come up with some version of Murkowski and get the little oval.
Okay. Yeah, that's
Let's go to Dermot for a minute. Dermot, how much confidence can we have in these polls based on your experience? And you've now been watching Alaska elections for more than 30 years.
Well, I think, Mike, the pollsters will probably tell you that they're pretty accurate, and the campaigns will tell you that they're accurate if they're favorable. But there's a great amount of doubt, and I think that's just going to increase as time goes by. On the write-in in particular, I think it's fascinating that there's going to be a write-in penalty that has to be attached to all this, and that is there'd be a certain percentage of voters who may intend to vote for Lisa Murkowski who don't end up either writing her name clearly enough, or filling in the oval. So there's
or they could put it on the wrong line.
Or they could write, if they just use the name Murkowski. I mean, I guess clearly the state is going to have to be more explicit in advance about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable in terms of a write-in. But all the polls have to be adjusted somewhat to take into account how many people will fill out the ballot incorrectly.
Let's go to Brendan for a minute. Brendan, what do you see in these polls?
Well, Ivan's poll, which Ivan is a columnist for the Anchorage Press as well, so we have that out in this week's issue. But in his poll, the Krashian and the CNN polls were criticized by Nate Silver of 538.com, the sort of guru of number crunching nationally, because they put them head-to-head, Miller, Murkowski, McAdams. In Ivan's poll, what he asked was Miller or McAdams, the first question. And many people, I think 20% volunteered, I'm writing in Lisa Murkowski. Those that did not volunteer that were then asked, knowing that Lisa Murkowski is a writing candidate, would you change your answer from the first question? And many of them did. And in the end, in that particular question, that put Murkowski up 8 points in Ivan's poll. So that's sort of best case scenario. And actually, she pulled more from McAdams voters than she did from Miller voters, which is very interesting. And one of the things that that Dermot said about filling in the oval, there's been some talk in the national press of the fact you can register to be a write-in candidate up to 5 days before the polls or before the election, and both parties are looking at registering Lisa M. somethings. So that it messes things up even more. And we can just imagine the morass of attorneys from both parties. And Lisa will have to pay for her own, obviously, since she's not running as a Republican. But the number of attorneys in the rooms pouring over these signatures is going to be ridiculous, particularly if the Democrat and Republican parties do register Lisa M. somethings as write-in candidates. And I believe Politico.com did it, searched through the records, and there's some 180 Lisa M.'s who are registered voters who could possibly be registered as write-in candidates in the state.
And Jill, you have to wonder what percentage of mistakes voters will make because they're busy, they're distracted, they just, people make mistakes. I do, filling out forms all the time.
Mm-hmm. I know the Murkowski campaign would counter saying, look, Alaskan voters are intelligent. If they want to make this vote, we know they can do it. We can educate them to do it, and people can stay focused because the election matters enough to do that. Certainly, the other campaigns have argued and will continue to argue that it's a huge burden to overcome.
It is. Yeah, and the state of Minnesota is a very educated state, and I know there were people who voted for, you know the one I mean, in the Al Franken Coleman race. People made all kinds of strange marks and references to the devil. I mean, if you get down to 200 or 300 people who are either not paying attention or having sport with the ballot, I don't doubt that somebody in Alaska will vote for Frank Murkowski. It'll just happen that way. I was going to add one thing here. yesterday, I sent an email to the chairman of the political science department at the University of Wisconsin, who I thought I had reason to believe had some expertise on polling and the question of write-ins. He said, He didn't really, because these rarely come up. But and this one's unusual because Lisa Murkowski is so well known and respected by many people that when you get write-ins in most states, it's not that kind of thing. And yet at the same time, when you're asking in a poll, there's a certain bias if you bring up her name, but there's also a certain bias if you don't bring up her name. So Professor Coleman of the University of Wisconsin was sort of, in the end, perplexed about how you could do this and have confidence in the numbers, and he suggested that we take a look at a variety of polls, which we're doing right here in this room amongst us, except they all seem to be different, right, Brendan?
Well, and I think Dave Dittman said in a phone call with me earlier this week that, look, it's close enough, it's neck and neck, that it's really anybody's guess at this point, particularly taking into account the challenges with how do you adapt your methodology to have pure results.
You had something, Brendan?
Oh, I was just going to say it's anybody's guess in any election when you look at these pollsters. I mean, Ethan Berkowitz was a lock as far as the polls go in 2008 against Don Young in the congressional race. So, you know, you got to take the polls with a grain of salt.
Let's go back to Dermot for a minute. Dermot, maybe we could just ask this about instead of polling, we'll just use you as our one-man poll. What's the vibe up there?
In Fairbanks, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the vibe here is the same as it is elsewhere. I think it's anybody's race. I have no clue as to how this is going to come out. Of course, you have to remember, I said there was no chance that Joe Miller would win the primary, and I know I was not alone in saying that, but no. But I was wrong.
I'd have to fire you, except then I'd have to fire myself.
Well, you know, the thing is about a couple points to make here. Murkowski has done an excellent job since she announced that write-in in getting incredible coverage on it. And incredible, I mean, in terms of widespread. Everybody in Alaska knows about this write-in campaign, I think. So it's not as if this is sneaking up on anybody. So as to whether or not she wins, it'll be whether or not she continues that sort of effort to attract notoriety to what she's doing. As far as Miller goes, yeah. he has to win over people who didn't vote for him in the primary. So he has a fairly a large challenge facing him here. McAdams, has to become well known. He's not very well known still outside of Southeast, although that is changing as the days go by.
There's one other thing to think about. If Lisa Murkowski got more than, let's say, 100,000 votes in the write-in, and that was enough to win, and to be very charitable, 2% of the people filled out the ballot wrong, that would cost her 2,000 votes. So all I'm saying here is any missed ballot or mistake has big consequences, or could. Mm-hmm. Okay, Jill, let's go back to you. The Republicans at the top of the ticket are announcing that they're not just conservatives, but they're constitutional conservatives. What are they trying to tell us?
Well, I think they want to be a unified front. I think that they're sticking to this kind of character of principled leadership. We're going to fight the feds, Alaska's interests first, the government is headed in the wrong direction. I mean, all the catchphrases that we heard in the primary, we're now kind of hearing in a more concentrated and perhaps focused form. Governor Sean Parnell gave his endorsement to Joe Miller.
And that was probably really good news for Miller, wasn't it?
Oh, I'm sure it was. How could it not be?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I mean, he's just adding to his list of endorsements. And they're kind of a unified front. These are people who want change in Washington. These are people who think that the federal government is overreaching. They think that Alaska's interests aren't being best served. And they think that, again, they return to these catchphrases of principled leadership, constitutional conservatives, back to basics, and strip away the excesses.
Okay. Dermot, how's Sean Parnell holding up in Fairbanks as the campaign proceeds?
Well, both Parnell and Miller are this is a strong area for them. I might sort of add something about the term constitutional conservative. Really, what has to be done here by reporters covering this is to bear down on what that means. Now, Joe Miller has said over and over again that he wants to get the federal government eventually out of Social Security. He's also suggested that unemployment compensation is unconstitutional, and he has made the comment that there's no constitutional basis for the federal government owning two-thirds of the land in Alaska. Those are some examples of what he means by constitutional conservative, going back to the Constitution as it was written. And if it's not explicitly justified in the Constitution, then it's not constitutional. That's really what this is about, and we have to really get beyond that catchphrase.
like the Air Force, as Senator Murkowski pointed out.
Yeah.
But Miller supporters will tell you, well, yeah, the Air Force has its origins in the Army. So therefore, it is constitutionally justified and in line with the views of a constitutional conservative. Now, there's probably room for argument about that, because how do you deal with federal regulation dealing with the Internet or the interstate highway system?
And the fact that the founders themselves had very deep disputes about what the Constitution meant very soon after they signed it. Brendan, meanwhile, what is Democratic candidate Ethan Berkowitz saying in the gubernatorial race?
Well, I thought it was really interesting when I read the Daily News on Sunday to see our occasional colleague Paul Jenkins writing a column about Ethan Berkowitz saying there's a real Republican in the race, given that Ethan's obviously a Democrat. But he's pretty much...
Paul's fond of the left-handed compliment.
Yes. Ethan's pretty much staking his campaign on this Alaska's ownership stake deal, and he's unveiling something new to do with that, I believe the fourth and final element of it, either today or tomorrow. But the first three are Alaskan ownership of the gas line, being able to invest part of your permanent fund dividend into the gas line, lifetime hunting and fishing licenses, which is, there's precedent for that. I believe 27 other states offer that. And then eliminating taxes on businesses that bring in up to $90,000 a year, I believe, and then lowering the corporate taxes above that from 9.4 to 4.9%, I believe. So those are the three elements he's unveiled so far. That's what Paul liked as a Republican. And that's pretty much been Ethan's campaign thus far, is these pretty big ideas, I think. And Parnell...
Well, one thing they certainly do is generate news coverage.
They do. And unlike Parnell, because much like the primary, Parnell's sort of kept quiet and just, you know, counted on the fact that he's the incumbent, although he's not the elected incumbent, as we all know. And we don't hear much except for, G is working, ACES is working, let's go forward.
And we'll sue the federal government.
And we'll for anything. Okay.
Brendan, time for some relief from politics. Deborah Allen, the cat lady, big story in your paper, the Anchorage Press, as she takes on the man. Tell us about
yes.
this.
Yeah, we actually did a cover story.
It's a joy to hear an old-fashioned phrase from my youth, like the man.
I wrote that headline. Deborah Allen was the lady who, last October, about a year ago, her home was raided. She operated a shelter of sorts for animals. And a lot of them were sick. There were some 80 cats, some lizards, 8 dogs, and in various degrees of having diseases.
No politicians.
No politicians that we're aware of. Anyway, she was sentenced. Scott's sort of been following the story. Scott Christensen, yes.
Veteran reporter.
Veteran reporter for the Anchorage Press, yes. And she was just recently sentenced, and his latest story is about her sentencing, because she really, they offered her several plea deals along the way, but all of the plea deals required that she was not allowed to own animals for 10 years. And because of the capacity limitations of animal control here in Anchorage, they weren't able to seize all of her animals. Some stayed in this condo that she owns and were continued to be taken care of by her or her friends. So she kept refusing these plea deals that said she couldn't have animals because animal control does euthanasia. And so when she was sentenced, she had a little tirade, hence the cat lady hisses at the man headline. She had a little tirade against Meyer Wilson, who is the person in charge of the Anchorage Animal Control, and said, she's not a cat lady. This woman has been a veterinarian for 19 years before becoming head of the animal shelter. But she ended up getting sentenced to 10 years probation and not allowed to have animals for 10 years. And she has to pay some form of restitution, but that's yet to be determined by the judge.
And it's always interesting and unusual when cases like this get into the court system, where you think of titans of industry squaring off or civil rights questions being debated. And this is essentially an animal protection, animal cruelty
35 misdemeanor case. Counts. Yeah,
35. And it seemed to me, reading between the lines, that what the government, the prosecutors were saying, could you just please stop doing this?
They really were, and she initially, she ended up firing this attorney, but she initially up until the sentencing phase, had an attorney who had some animal issues himself. His home was raided because he had a hybrid woof dog mix, which is illegal here. And the
Can you get disbarred for that?
No, but the government actually seized some of his files from his home office, and he made sort of a stink that they were getting his defense files for the Deborah Allen case. So there's even more animal intrigue to this story.
Okay, Dermot, the Fairbanks report, you're going to have an election up there next Tuesday. Why don't you tell us what the outlook is and what else concerns Fairbanks as winter approaches?
Well, Mike, just to continue the bit of relief from politics for just a second, I just learned today that Peggy Shoemaker, who's a prominent poet in Alaska, will be the Alaska State Writer Laureate for 2010 to 2012. And she's really quite well known in the Fairbanks area, and people are really going to be happy about that. Getting back to politics, yes, we have a local election next week. And there's actually some discussion here among people that, gee, isn't this the wrong time of year to have a local election? And shouldn't we follow the Anchorage example and have it in the spring when maybe there's more time to focus on local issues? The state and national elections really overshadow the local races, but one of the key things that is up next week is an initiative that would prevent the Fairbanks North Star Borough from issuing fines against people for violating wood smoke pollution regulations that were recently adopted. If this passes, it would probably turn this whole issue over to the Department of Environmental Conservation, and that could be a dispute in a few years to come as to whether or not Fairbanks comes to grips with the air pollution problem here, or whether DEC is going to enforce some measures to keep road money flowing to Alaska. So that's probably the main issue on the ballot. The city mayor is also up for re-election, Terry Sturl. She's being challenged by longtime council member Jerry Cleworth. And there are several races, the normal races for the borough assembly and the school board. Other than that, we haven't had any snow yet, and I know Anchorage is, I think...
Well, that's always on the front page, and as is the idea that Fairbanks will be interested in copying Anchorage. Jill, the Washington Post has had extensive coverage, front page, big stories of 8A contracting. They really put a lot of work into it, didn't they?
Yeah, my understanding is this was nearly a year-long investigation,
oh, really?
7 or 8 months, I think. They profiled a lot of the aspects that are deeply troubling for a lot of people about the Alaska Native Corporation. Small business set-asides that allow these companies to get unlimited sole source contracts of any value with no competition. And that's been the source of a lot of consternation for members of Congress as well as critics of the corporations themselves. I think that the Post report does a really nice job laying out all of that and some of the interplay that takes place in those decisions.
Had the amount of money been, excuse me for interrupting you, but had the amount of money that the Post put forward as, you know, what had been spent, $29 billion, has that been reported here?
It has, yeah.
Okay.
That's not. I don't believe that that's new information. They had explosive growth in the last decade. A lot of that had to do with the special preferences and the privileges that they're allowed to utilize through the small business development program. I think, you know, one of the things that may not come out as clearly as it could in this story, and which is just a problem in general, is solving this problem of these corporations take in huge amounts of tax money by way of these government contracts, but they are just a small section of the whole contracting world in general. In
and
which,
it being tens of billions of dollars employing thousands of people who have nothing to do with Alaska.
In which lots of middlemen and lots of brokers are making millions and millions and millions of dollars, and that's the kind of the cost of doing business, and that's the reality of if that's what you're worth in the marketplace, that's what the marketplace is going to pay you. And I don't know how you get at that by specifically targeting Alaska Native corporations. Certainly, there are questions of transparency and ensuring that the money is making it down to the villagers and the corporate shareholders to whom these entities are designed to benefit. And there's great disparity from, you know, the top performers and these impoverished village locals who really aren't seeing much benefit, they believe, from this existing. But it's a congressional mandate. They are kind of quasi-public, but they're still private companies. And how much oversight do you really want government in an entity that's supposed to be self-determining, and how much transparency is appropriate to make sure that the, you know, lawmakers or taxpayers or shareholders feel comfortable with the trickle-down effect of that money without giving up, like, proprietary secrets. I mean, I think they're real challenges.
Right. You outlined it very well. We're going to run out of time here, Brendan, but in the minute we have remaining, the corruption trials take a strange turn as former prosecutor Nicholas Marsh takes his own life.
Yeah, it's a really sad story. And from what I've read about it, he felt scapegoated. The other prosecutors who were under investigation got to continue working for the Department of Justice while he went to their Office of International Affairs and was not prosecuting cases. And his friends are saying he's of the utmost character and integrity, but really felt sidelined and scapegoated. It's just another tragic turn.
20 seconds. Is Bruce Weirach ever going to be tried?
I don't know. We'll find out. I mean, they're certainly preparing as though they will. The government's case has a blow to it. They're supposed to respond late this month.
Is there a trial date?
No, I don't know that there's a trial date at this point, but the government has a month, I believe, to respond to this latest development and decide how they're going to proceed. Right now,
that
it should go to trial.
That is evidence being withheld. Or rather, charges being reduced.
I don't know if it's charges being reduced as so much as they're not allowed to bring in one element of bribery and kickbacks that didn't exist.
And we're not allowed to continue any longer because we're out of time. Good night.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.